Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 22nd of March with me, Ian Welsh. A few days ago, I caught up with Seif Hamid, CEO of Altruistic, and we talked about some of the challenges for companies tackling their Scope 3 supply chain emissions and common mistakes they make. That's to come. First, though, are some insights recorded at this week's Innovation Forum Responsible Sourcing and Ethical Trade Forum in London, when I spoke with Alenka Turnsek, partner at EY, and Andrei Savchenko, Regional Vice President, Forced Labour Programmes for Asia Pacific at the International Justice Mission. Joining me now is Alenka Turnsek, partner at EY. Welcome.
Thank you, Ian.
How do you characterise the evolving business and human rights legislative landscape?
So we've gone from a set of voluntary guidelines at the international level to mandatory legislation, probably in the space of the last few years, the most notable of which is the German Supply Chain Act. Before that, we have the German-French Vigilance Act. And now, of course, we have the CSDDD, so Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. And we shouldn't forget that we have a number of mandatory elements relating to social elements and human rights in other pieces of Green Deal legislation. So we've gone from voluntary to mainly mandatory.
And what are the challenges then for companies with this process of fragmentation almost is coming through?
There is fragmentation within the EU legislation itself, and then we have a question of interoperability between EU legislation and other parts of the world where they may or may not have the mandatory or voluntary guidelines. So for right now, for companies, it's complex because they do need to look at each individually, but when they do an assessment, they need to take them as a bundle. It means a lot of additional administration, potentially a lot of additional data, but as the legislation goes, we're hoping that there will be a few obstacles to seamlessness in the first few years, but over the years that will standardize and simplify.
It feels to me like this is a lot about materiality. How do companies ensure that they do address what's most material?
Our companies cannot really address everything to the last detail. It's, for one, probably administratively not possible, and two, commercially does not make a lot of sense. So what happened is two things. Legislation either itself looks at the high-risk areas or high-risk commodities, so there's a risk-based approach built into the legislation. So if you look at EU deforestation regulation, it looks at the most at-risk commodities. But then something like CSDDD includes a risk-based approach. A lot of human rights legislation does look at risk-based approach. So you look at what is most material in terms of impactful and in terms of the most widespread in the supply chains, and that's the approach that business has taken previously on a voluntary basis, and now it's to an extent been built into legislation as well.
Do you think that we're now getting the regulation that businesses have been calling for the past 10 years?
We have to be careful what we wish for. I think some businesses would say we might have gotten more than what we wished for. The key point here is interoperability is what we hear businesses say. So it's fine to have legislation, but as long as not every piece requires something different. The concern is it'll turn into a tick-the-box exercise to stay compliant as opposed to qualitatively address each piece of legislation and underlying human rights and social elements issues.
What's the future going to look like then? How do you think this whole area is going to evolve?
What we have so far is a principle of transparency and traceability within supply chain that includes human rights and includes social elements. We have gone to accountability of the brands or the main companies in the ecosystem. I think what we haven't necessarily addressed is the seamlessness of how that gets identified, monitored and addressed. So a little bit of underlying with the data, so digitization of the information. And then, as I said, we are probably in a bit of a let's make sure we're compliant as opposed to let's move into the improvement mode. So we're going to see one digital data, and then the other one is that substantive improvement that is based on the minimum standards that legislation has set out.
That's great. It's interesting to see how things do develop. Alenka Turnsek from EY, thanks very much. Joining me now is Andrei Savchenko from the International Justice Mission. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Ian.
What for you is the scale of the problem of forced labor globally right now?
What we see from the Global Estimates on Modern Slavery, which is a very well-researched report published in 2022 from the IOM, the ILO, and Walk Free, is that there are 28 million individuals in situations of modern slavery any given day. That was in 2021. That's more than the population of Australia. It's individuals who are actually in real-life situations of being coerced to work and remain in abusive labor conditions. Can look like debt bondage, or can look like retention of personal identity documents that doesn't allow you to leave, or can look like violence, beatings, threats, and the like.
We had a very moving testimony from a survivor of modern slavery, an incident from around a decade ago.
How relevant are the learnings from his example? How much do they reflect what's happening right now in supply chains?
Disturbingly relevant. We at IJM have conducted some research just in the past year and a half, along with the University of Chicago, the National Opinion Research Council at the University of Chicago, with support from the Walmart Foundation. The research was similar to Jaipeng's experiences of migrant workers in Thailand, migrant workers from Myanmar and from Cambodia. Specifically, we, as part of the research, surveyed 1,200 migrant workers and found that 21% of them had experienced abusive labor conditions without a reasonable opportunity to leave. Applying the ILO indicators, that was 18% had experienced forced labor according to the ILO framework. That's just a high prevalence, almost 1 in 5 workers who have experienced forced labor current state.
So what are some of the solutions then?
Our understanding from our work in this space over 2 decades is that forced labor persists in jurisdictions principally where rule of law is not being enforced to be a factor at all in the behavior of people who are operating forced labor businesses. That is, they are operating and have been operating forced labor practices as a part of their business without consequences. And so changing that cost-benefit analysis for illegal operators is really, really crucial to behavior change, which then results to protection. And so introducing the threat of law enforcement or enforcement of worker protection laws and regulations, critical, right? So that enforcement can look like fines, jail sentences in serious cases. It can look like revocation of business licenses, but it's important that there be a consequence that will deter forced labor operators protecting workers. And so the solution then is building capacity of host country governments in high-risk jurisdictions to enforce laws. It's improving worker-driven, trauma-informed processes for people who are survivors of forced labor. It is demonstrating that there is a tangible benefit to these formal remediation processes that workers will want to report cases. Tall order, but possible.
And what's the role of companies in this then?
Companies have a critical role because host country governments care very much what buyers of the products that their countries are producing, what they think is important, right? And so companies already advocate with governments on a whole host of different issues. What can be a difference maker for workers in the most vulnerable jurisdictions is for companies to actually approach those governments and say, hey, we'd love to source more in your country, but what we really need from you is enforcement of worker protection laws across supply chains, across the whole jurisdiction, because it levels the playing field for all competitors, for all suppliers, and it really reduces the risk of forced labor being found in those supply chains of those buyers. That can be a hugely important role, and we've seen it work.
Andriy Savchenko from International Justice Mission, thanks very much.
Thank you, Ian.
Recently, I was pleased to speak once again with Saif Hamid, CEO of Altruistic.
We're going to talk a bit about Scope 3 today. There are a lot of conversations going on right now about how companies should engage suppliers on their Scope 3 emissions. How would you characterize where we are on this at the moment?
I think there's 2 approaches, Ian, for how companies are doing this. And I think both approaches are also sponsored and backed by different sorts of vendors and solution providers. One approach is the top-down thinking, which is you don't actually need to go out there and engage with suppliers. You can effectively do all of this remotely and potentially with the help of satellite technology and a good set of data sets that you can procure directly, you might actually not need to go out to the supply chain at all. There's a second school of thought, which is actually you not only need to go out to the supply chain, but you need to get every single supplier out there to fill out a form of some sort and provide you with a data stream. And that the best way to do that is therefore to have one solution to rule them all, at least for an industry. And I think both of these are out there in the market, so to speak. What I find anecdotally, and I ask this question a lot, particularly from food and beverage companies and consumer businesses, the market or the companies or the sustainability professionals inherently gravitate towards the latter, which is that the bias in business is that you need to have primary data. And to get primary data, you need to get it through actual data entry or some form of actual data provision by every supplier. Personally, I think that neither approach is fully correct. In the first approach, you have to have good primary data to train the secondary data on. And a lot of the satellite data out there just doesn't have the kind of granularity that you need to make decisions. And if it does, it's going to be far too expensive in practice for business. At the same time, the sort of go out there and get data from every single supplier approach is also prohibitively expensive, prohibitively onerous, and lacks any form of real robust controls, audit, assurance to make sure that data is being entered correctly, even with the best of intentions. So I actually think there's a bit of a hybrid approach you need with good primary data sampling and then training effective models and data science to get outcomes or output that is good enough for decision making.
And do you think that companies are beginning to move towards a hybrid approach, or are they still stuck in the two buckets?
I think it depends firstly on industry. And so if you look at, let's say, the food and beverage industry, Altruistiq works with some of the largest companies in this space, and we favor a hybrid approach. So we believe in getting larger and larger sets of data points, let's call them an environmental factor database or however you want to call it, enriching it with supplier-specific data on a category basis. That means that for a certain category of suppliers, you want to start getting good primary data and then training models to create better extrapolations from that. So that's the approach that we pioneer, or at least we promote. The rest of the market is basically being led by one set of solutions or the other, or one set of coalitions, or one set of framing or the other. And I think there's frankly a lot of chaos. I do expect this to settle. So for instance, the fashion apparel space has historically believed very strongly in the primary data capture approach and believes every garment manufacturer everywhere in the world should be on the same index. And ideally, they then push that back further up into the value chain. As the momentum to get decent quality sustainability data increases, you see all the cracks in this kind of one solution to rule them all approach, which is you just can't get coverage fast enough. And so I do think that progressively, we're either going to get a lot more money spent and a lot more momentum on satellite technology or other approaches. I personally don't think that's likely to be fast enough or good enough. And so I think everyone is going to coalesce around the hybrid approach.
It is obviously a daunting area for companies. Let's get into this a little bit more deeply. So how do they go about identifying, you know, scope 3 hotspots?
The traditional way, or the way that most large companies, specifically in the consumer space, which is the space that I maybe know best, are doing this, is they tend to basically take all their suppliers and then they do a few cuts. The first cut might be actually, which are the materials that I'm buying that are inherently high emissions materials? And you can also apply the same approach for water. You can probably apply the same approach for nature and biodiversity impact as well. Which materials are inherently a challenging or a problematic material? So in the food space, let's say, think about packaging materials of all types. Think about chemicals. Think about flavors and fragrances, sugar, dairy, meat. The list goes on. There's probably about 20, 30, 40, 50 materials that you think about that are inherently in this category. I think there's a second pass that you do and a second, let's say, filter, which is, where am I buying large volumes? Probably, actually, there's a really good overlap between those two, but there'll also be some suppliers that actually fit in one bucket but not in the other and are still relevant. So what I mean by that is you might have a relatively small supplier where you're not buying a lot of volume, but the material they're providing is inherently really high emissions. Again, think about a flavor or a fragrance. To make a small amount of flavor or fragrance, you're usually basically taking a huge amount of agricultural output and effectively distilling it down into a really small amount of mass. And so that's a material that even if you're buying a really small amount, it's just inherently going to be punching above its weight. Similarly, there might be something that's actually quite low emissions, but you're buying such a huge amount of it that actually that exaggerates it. Those two filters are the most important, and those are the ones that most companies are already applying. I think there's a third filter that it will increasingly gather steam and momentum. And I think the third filter is, what is a material that is intrinsically associated with your product? What is a material that your consumer or your customer thinks about immediately when they're buying your product? Think about a chocolate bar, you think of cocoa. Think about, you know, anything with coffee, pretty much, you'll think of the coffee bean. There's a few products that inherently command your attention towards a certain raw material or ingredient. And I think it's useful for you to have that as an additional layer. It's probably still going to be captured in your first bucket and your second bucket, but it's useful for you to think about that as maybe a layer of prioritization. Starbucks, I think, puts it very nicely, which is when they talk about coffee, they say Starbucks has to solve for coffee, because if Starbucks doesn't solve for coffee, no one else will solve for coffee. That's their share of the global problem. And I think that's a great way to think about this. And I know a lot of the other forward-leaning companies approach it with the same logic. And so those are the three filters I would take. And then depending on how you cut it, I think you'll probably find that there are maybe 100 suppliers or even less where actually all three filters are true. This is an inherently associated with your product material. It's a large category of volume for you, and the material is inherently high emissions. And then I think you'll probably get maybe anywhere from 300 to 700 or 800 suppliers that kind of fit across the rest of it as well.
To a greater or lesser extent, this is really just an exercise in materiality.
I think that materiality has been done slightly differently, let's say 6 years ago or 7 years ago, versus how it's being done now and how it'll be done in the future. 6 or 7 years ago, the trend was to create something like a materiality index. And so it's a simple, like it's a 2x2 or a 4-quadrant chart or so. And you say, what are all the issues that are material for my business and that a customer or an outsider or a stakeholder might think about? And you sort of like put them all there. And so you might have, look, there's a biodiversity risk. There's a social aspect. There's a human rights liability here as well. And you can kind of plot them all there. That's evolved because that used to be a strategic tool to set a high level direction. I think that the new materiality analysis is much more granular, where it starts to think about individual materials and individual suppliers. Ultimately, you start to want to put this together with carbon pricing, where you can actually start to put a price on the materiality of this specific input that you're buying and start to create better tools for decision makers within the organization, ideally even buying teams within the organization. That, I think, is the direction of materiality as a concept.
What are the common errors here then? What are the things that you see companies getting wrong when they're taking this approach?
I think that there are a couple of errors. I think one is that they tend to think geographically rather than archetypally. And what I mean by that is, I know that a lot of food companies, food and beverage companies in Europe have a mental model where they want to prioritize European suppliers first. And they say, look, let's first solve for Europe. Let's figure out emerging markets in other parts of the world later. But within Europe, let's try and solve for all suppliers. Like, let's try and get every small farm, every SME, as many as we can to give us some sort of data in some shape or form. And I actually think that the better approach is to split up your world of suppliers into archetypes and cohorts. And so let's say you think about a packaging supplier, for instance. You might find that a mid-sized packaging supplier in India has a lot, you know, someone, let's say, doing a few hundred million dollars, $500 million of revenue, actually has a lot more in common with a mid or even a larger size packaging supplier in Europe, because that mid-sized supplier in India actually sees themselves as a leader in their industry, and they're already competing tooth and nail for share of wallet with their customers, and their mindset is quite forward-leaning. I actually see this all the time, and I think two good examples come to mind. One is in the fashion and apparel space, where I know that most third-party manufacturers anywhere in the world, whether it's Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, are actually like quite far ahead versus the average company across any sector in Europe. And that's because the pressure is just higher and they're used to trying to win on any given playing field because the market is so competitive. And I think you'll find that a lot of companies subscribe to that. And so thinking archetypally, whether it's by size of business that's in the supply chain and by category or material type that they're providing you, and then slicing the world into grids that way or cells in a grid that way, I think that's a better approach and will probably get you more momentum towards actual emissions reduction.
I mean, I guess this is about finding where to get into the detail. So how can companies work on the granularity of their carbon emissions at a product level, for example?
We talk about this a lot. And so also, like, if anyone's interested, I think we did a podcast on a similar topic just recently, our State of Sustainability podcast. There's two directions of travel here as well. One is to say, let's try and get as much data into the system as possible at as high a level of granularity as possible. And the other is, let's try and push for quality, and actually smaller data sets are better because we can get better quality there. A lot of companies are jumping into product level footprinting before they actually have either. They have neither the granularity and the volume, nor do they have the quality. A better way to approach it is to set a template for something that's repeatable based on a few products. So take a few products, a few brands in the portfolio, something that's iconic, even maybe just start with a few SKUs, and think about what is a repeatable way to deliver the use case of getting a product level data set. And the use case is not just to get a number, the use case is to get a number that is good enough for you to redesign the product. If you take, let's say, a bottle of ketchup or a bar of soap or a chocolate bar, you kind of want to say, okay, look, let me start with a location, let me start with a set of suppliers, let me start with a particular bill of materials. And then let me say, what is a level of granularity that I need to be able to make good decisions? So you now already start going a level or two below spend-based information. You're looking for locations and you're looking for weights. And you're looking to actually design a system that can predictably take that bill of materials data combined with that purchasing data, combined with some data around locations. So for example, where are you manufacturing or processing it? And actually allocate those numbers together so that you can predictably give a breakdown of a particular product. And then you can start to make strategic decisions. You can say, well, actually, I'm making the same chocolate bar in two different facilities, and the numbers I'm getting are very different. Is that because I have a problem in the data? Is it because I have a problem in the data model that's delivering that output and I need to tweak something? Or is there actually an interesting insight for me just in how this product is being supplied or created or designed? And so I think that's the approach that is likely to be most scalable, but also most valuable. And I would start small with a few products, a few stock keeping units, and then I would scale up from there.
Thinking of the data then, data itself, what are the secrets to unlocking those right levels of insight that you've just been discussing? I mean, what are the kind of ways that you can ensure you're getting the right data that gives you that insight?
So what we think about is we first typically try to understand what data is available within the business. And usually, if you think about what's used for sustainability purposes, very often it's a subset of the data that's actually available. A good example, and this is not a scope three example, but it demonstrates the point. If you think about energy data, most large or even mid-sized businesses will consolidate or aggregate or capture their energy data somewhere, but they'll typically miss details like the tariff, for instance, or the location, or maybe the date. These data points could all be very useful for computing emissions. The same is true for purchasing data, where a lot of emissions calculations might historically have been done with data around, let's say, spend or data around weights or data around locations. But maybe you actually ignore data around the actual supplier, or maybe you ignore data around the currency, for instance. And actually, all these aspects could be useful for you, not just in computing the emissions, but also potentially in running analytics later on. For us, when we take in data at Altruistic, we're trying to capture the whole of the data sets available to us, which means that if you think of like a tabular data set, like a spreadsheet or an export from a system, we're trying to capture every column that's available. Because there might be categories of data that we realize we might not need just to do the emissions calculation job, but actually maybe it's going to be very useful for running analysis later on. So maybe we can actually see drop-off points for where a delivery was delivered, and that's going to be super useful to help the business redesign a process flow. Those sorts of things I think are going to be quite helpful. And so I would start with trying to understand what is available within the business, what exists out there. There's value in capturing as much of it as possible, and then starting to use whatever is available based on specific use cases.
You work with lots of big businesses, different sectors around the world. What are the key opportunities that you're seeing emerging for companies that get this right?
I think there are going to be multiple types of opportunities depending on where in the value chain you sit. Right now, I think that the most interesting opportunities are probably for three types of business. There's one for a very large consumer goods company, let's say a Unilever or a Mars or a Kraft Heinz, those sorts. A second, I would say, is for a challenger brand. And a third, I would say, is for a B2B supplier. And let me go into each of those three in a little more detail, if I may. If I think about a Unilever or a Mars or Kraft Heinz, these companies already have large commitments on sustainability, which means that they've already put something out there into the public space. They've already got brand equity on the line. And so getting this right means potentially saving money on implementation, means protecting the brand, means limiting risk as well. If you think about what risk looks like, I mean, in the public space right now, you can see the backlash against H&M a couple of years ago around the numbers on the products. You can see the lawsuit against Oatly, which I think is currently ongoing in the UK from some shareholders. That's kind of just what the risk looks like. And obviously, the bigger the company, the bigger the brand, the bigger the risk. So I think for the large consumer goods companies, that's the opportunity here. For the challenger brands, I think there's a really good opportunity to create an impression or a synthesis in the consumer mind, which means that the consumer associates you with a feel-good product. The impact of that can be small increments, but on every single purchase. Let me give you an example. If you think about where most chocolate bars and candies are purchased, a very large share, if not a majority, are impulse buys right at the counter before you pay the cash. You're about to pay the cash, you see a Kit Kat there and you throw in the Kit Kat, or you have a bit of change and you say, well, why not? You throw in the Kit Kat. And if you have two products there, let's say there's a Kit Kat and let's say there's a super sustainable Kit Kat, which might be a rival brand or rival company, the decision of picking one or the other is a split second impulse purchase that the consumer makes. And the consumer is actually not likely to revisit that impulse again and again. If they make that impulse purchase one time, then every time they go into that motion, they're very likely to actually, again, pick super sustainable Kit Kat. They're not even going to think about it in that split second. That is the enduring power of getting this right for a challenger brand, which I think is very special. If I look at the B2B companies, we're seeing this play out in a really big way. If you're a B2B, let's say, ingredient supplier into the food business, or you're a B2B supplier into apparel or fashion or fragrance, there's a really big opportunity for you to shift the dialogue with your customers from what it is today or has historically been, which is cost, volume, quality, timing, and shift it towards cost, volume, quality, timing, and sustainability. And the sustainability aspect is an angle that readily lends itself towards a strategic long-term partnership with your customer. And we see this playing out in a really powerful way, actually. If I look at, again, Unilever is a great example. The suppliers to Unilever that are doing this right are building massive amounts of goodwill on the Unilever side. And I think that they're seeing that goodwill play out in the form of cash support and co-investment, but also in terms of just a willingness to think much more long-term in terms of the relationship. And I think that's going to be very powerful. If you think about Apple as a business and how Apple has thought about its supply chain, the suppliers to Apple were happy to do business with Apple. The Foxconn and the big suppliers in China and Taiwan were happy to do business with Apple, even though they knew they'd make a razor-thin margin. But the reason they were happy to do that is because they would learn techniques and technology and skills that they could transfer to others. I don't think there's actually going to be this kind of margin contraction for a B2B supplier getting sustainability right. But I think there's an opportunity for a B2B supplier to Unilever really demonstrating their sustainability credentials to take the same playbook to Kraft Heinz and Danone and Mars and Mondelez and say, look, we've done it this way, and this way was perfect for Unilever. And Unilever has been one of the forward movers on this. This should be great to you as well. And trust us, we're the thought leaders on our product. I think that's going to be super powerful.
So looking forwards, though, what are the best practice next steps that you expect to see? And what are the ones you hope to see?
So if you kind of pick up, let's say, where we left off in terms of across those three filters of material type and, let's say, volume and strategic value or synergy, we're going to see two or three things happen. As in, basically, I think we're going to see the large companies start to think about their suppliers in two or three categories. There's going to be one category, which is this is the set that we need to own. Like, this is our part of the problem. This is the coffee, the roaster for Starbucks, the beef supplier for McDonald's, that category where this is our part of the problem. And I think you're going to see the big brands lean in quite assertively to make sure that that part of the problem transitions. And I think there's going to be a lot of carrots and a lot of sticks. I think there's going to be co-investment in change interventions. And I think there's going to be a lot of, you kind of have to do this, otherwise there won't be more volume coming your way. And I expect data systems and data quality to also evolve very rapidly at those interfaces. I think there's going to be a second category, which is, these are not the top 30, 50, 60 suppliers that sit across all those three filters. This is the 500, 600, 700 suppliers that are going to be material for any consumer goods business. And in that case, I think that you're going to have a lot more industry coordination. I think there's going to be an interesting challenge around how that happens in a pre-competitive space, because you can't actually have Danone and Nestle and Mars all literally showing up to certain suppliers and saying, we want you to do this, because that would be collusion. And so I think you're going to have a need for, whether it's industry coalitions or even solution providers like us or others, to be more actively involved in helping shape the direction of that middle heartland of suppliers that are just generic contributors to the emissions of every big consumer business. And then I think you kind of have the everyone else. And by the way, I think that second category will be global. And I think the first category will be global as well. I think the everyone else will also be global. And I think the everyone else will be a collection of mid-sized businesses in low emissions materials that are just not strategic for anyone from a sustainability perspective, plus, let's say, lots and lots of little SMEs, which are just too small to actually move the needle. And I think that long tail, like, it's going to be a sort of a lumpy long tail. I think that actually we'll just see a lot of focus and attention shift from that. And there'll be a compliance playing field where you just have to share something and there's not going to be a lot of scrutiny, and you have to kind of fill out your forms and do your paperwork. And it's going to be like, you know, making sure that there's no child labor in the value chain. It's going to be kind of that level of QC and yes, no, and a bit of diligence. But I don't think you're going to be expected to have this rigorous data-driven collaboration-oriented exchange with your customers. So those are the things that I expect to see coming.
And what about things that are more aspirational? What would you like to see?
I would like to see much more sophisticated carbon pricing. And I'd like to see that carbon pricing make its way into buying decisions. And I think that the way that needs to happen is that a business needs to work out, what is the cost for me to transition my dairy industry or my dairy suppliers versus the cost to transition, let's say, cocoa or coffee or paper or whatever else, and work out a carbon price based on the cost to decarbonize. Like a carbon price, I always think is a bit of a misnomer. I actually think it's a carbon cost. You're not buying carbon. No one wants to buy carbon. Carbon is a liability. And so you need to think like, what is the cost for me to remove that liability from the product I'm buying? And then that kind of blends itself in to the purchase price that you're looking for on that material. So if I'm expecting to buy, let's say, sugar for $100, and I know that that $100 of sugar is going to cost me $20 to decarbonize, or it's going to cost someone $20 to decarbonize, then, you know, maybe I'm just basically deducting that. And I'm saying, look, I'm going to now pay you $80, or I'm going to pay you $90, and we're splitting the cost of decarbonization. I think that that's going to be a very formative sort of logic and narrative for the industry to move towards.
Well, it's been an interesting conversation as ever. Covered loads of ground, but Saif Hamid, founder and CEO at Altruistic, thanks very much.
I'm very pleased to have joined you, Ian. If anyone wants more of my views, feel free to check out my LinkedIn or just look for our podcast, State of Sustainability, on Spotify, Apple, or Google. But Ian, so glad to be here.
Thanks a lot, Saif.
The Innovation Forum website is, as ever, the place to go for all the latest analysis and interviews and all the details about our upcoming spring conference series and how to join us. We'll be back with the briefing next week, but that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and until next time, goodbye.